history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there really are heroes around you. There are unbelievable stories waiting to be told if we just invest a little bit of our time in listening. And that's what we're going to try to do for the next hour as we seek to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, preserve their stories so we never forget that price that's been paid for our freedom. And in that process, we end up learning so much. Not only are we educated, we are entertained, and often we really are inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. I certainly expect that to be the case today as we look ahead to the 76th anniversary of the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor. That'll take place this coming Thursday, December 7th, 2017, and today you're going to hear the voices of three men who were on three different ships in the harbor that morning. Not only are they all still living, they'll all be taking part in commemorations this week, and I'm going to tell you where you can go meet them Thursday and join them in honoring the fallen. Wherever you're listening to Hometown Heroes, there is almost certainly an event in your area to mark Pearl Harbor Day. And even if you're unable to find one there, you can hop online and watch a live stream of the official commemoration at Pearl Harbor. The theme for this 76th anniversary is Rising to the Challenge. The keynote speaker is author Steve Toomey. And the island of Oahu actually has a whole week's worth of events starting Saturday, December 2nd. I have that information linked for you at hometownheroesradio.com. I'm going to be in Clovis, California for the 76th anniversary. A ceremony there at the Clovis Veterans Memorial District will begin at 9:55 a.m., the exact time that the first planes bombed Pearl Harbor. At least two Pearl Harbor survivors will be there, and they both have pretty amazing stories that you're going to get a chance to hear today. We'll start with Joe Quercia. He's 95 now, but on December 7th, 1941, he was a 19-year-old sailor aboard the repair ship USS Medusa.
This kid that I joined the Navy with was Louis Gatewood. Louis and I just got done with breakfast that morning. We had our bunks down, and I was leaning on my bunk talking to him and his and looking out the porthole at Fort Island, just right across from us. And I told him, I said, my God, Louis, I says, they're having gunnery practice this morning. I says, them planes are all painted with red spots on them. And about time I got done with that saying, GQ sounded, and they said, this is war. Well, hell, I never knew anything about war or anything, you know, and went to your battle stations. And I was a topside sailor at that time. I didn't have too many years of service. Got to watch the whole thing from up topside. And there was one ship that went by, and the pilot was so close when he come down between the Curtis and us, and I gave him the finger. And maybe I shouldn't have done that. But you could see him in there just as clear as a bell, you know. Mm-hmm. I was thinking, I wonder if he'd turn around, come back, and try to shoot us, but he didn't. The Medusa had the 4 5-inch mounts, and all the firing equipment were at the base being worked on. They couldn't fire them. That's a service gun. And we had a 3-inch anti-aircraft gun on the top side, on the deck up on top side. And that, we got credit for a 2-man sub that came up between the Curtis and the Medusa. We put a shell through its conning tower, and we got one plane. And when it crashed later on a day after, so after one of our guys went over there and cut off some tin, I got a piece of the metal off of it. The next day, they put me in the boats, you know, being I was down below deck in engineering to run the boat. And then we had to go by and pick up them poor sailors that we found. We picked up 3 of them that next morning, and it still bothers me when I think about it. It's just...
That what was it like at the time for you? Were you numb to it, or was it a tough emotional thing at the time?
When I thought about the guys and saw the Arizona, because we had to go by the Arizona, it was still smoking and all that, and seeing all them battleships sitting on there out in the bay, the Oklahoma was over, and then watching the Utah capsize, it did bother me then. And there was only 58 guys that got killed on the Utah, but the story goes, the one kid jumped off in the ocean side in the bay area, and he was swimming over to the Curtis, and I saw him coming, I had the glasses on him, and about the time he got to the Curtis, Kamikaze, one of them jets decided to crash on the fantail of the Curtis, and he proceeded to come to our gangplank and come up on a gangplank. I got talking to him, he was a machinist mate, first class petty officer, and he said there was too much commotion on the Curtis, so he said I just kept swimming. came over to our ship, and I don't know where it happened to him. He stayed on because I got transferred off of it later on, you know, to come back for new construction. But a lot of other ships, there was some light cruiser parked by us. They were using anti-aircraft guns in the sky at night. There was the Enterprise sent two planes in to land at Ford Island. It's dark, so they said they'd give them IFF, but everybody's shoot happy, so they start landing, and we shot them both down, our own planes, and they had word, and they don't send any more in, because the sky was red with tracer bullets. Whenever you ship in there, machine guns or 1.1s on some of them ships, and they have tracer bullets, you can't believe how red the sky would get. That's the first time that I've seen it. I've seen it later on during the war years, but at that time, I thought, my God, how can a plane get through that, you know?
But in the attacks that morning, that anti-aircraft fire was not that imposing. It was, after all, a surprise attack, and the Japanese inflicted so much damage before American forces could even really respond.
The first bunch came over with fighters and torpedo bombers, and then when the horizontal bombers come through, they made some that carry bombs, and that's the one that went over there, Arizona. And when it went down through the armor deck and got into the magazine down, exploded, that's what caused that poor ship to go to hell. It just ripped it wide open, you know. And I thought they got the fuel docks because the smoke was so thick, because we were just on the opposite side of Ford Island. Ford Island ain't very wide, but you could see over there, it was just blacker than coal, and thought, God, they must have got the oil, but they didn't. They just got the Arizona.
And it wasn't until a visit to the USS Arizona Memorial in 2004 that Joe realized one of his friends from boot camp had been killed on that day of infamy.
He was on the vessel. His name is Harold Arnberg. He's from Madeira. And if you ever go there, right on the bottom of where all the men that was on Arizona, there's a little spot. Six people that was on the vessel. Harold Arnberg, his name's the first one. He went through boot camp with me and everything. And I didn't know that he was killed till I saw that. It kind of bothers you, you know, the thinking that you lost some of them. There might have been other people there, because there was 150 in our company. How many was gone and how many are alive today? I don't know. You know, you don't keep tracks of them. You never know who they are. But anyway, Harold was killed that morning. I don't know where he was on the vessel. They have him as a fireman. So he was a below deck sailor. So was I, below deck sailor. All my time was done below the waterline when I was, until I made chief. Mm-hmm. And we don't get no submarine pay. But if a torpedo would come through a ship, it would knock us out first thing, you know, because most of the boiler rooms were below the waterline. But it didn't happen. I'm here and I'm happy.
Me too. You saw the Utah go down?
Well, yeah, the Utah, it was a target ship. That's the one that they practice on. She came in where we tied up at our berth. We came in November 27th when the Utah was in our berth. And we usually tie up because we were battleship cruiser repair. We took care of fixing them because the Medusa was the only ship that could rebore a 16-inch gun. When we got there, what are we going to do? We're going to tell the Utah to get out. So we just went out to the first two buoys out there across from her and tied up between two buoys. She had our berth, and we have a fresh water line coming from Ford Island that we didn't have to make water while we were in port, so we could just tie onto it and get water from the base there. But she was in our berth, so we just stayed out. And the Curtis was tied up in front of us. I think it was the Detroit, the light cruiser, was tied up just ahead of the Utah. And then the Solis, which was the hospital ship, she was tied up about the backside. And there was a couple other ships, I forget the names of them, they were in there. But the Utah, when she got torpedoed, I was seeing it turning. I thought it was going to, you know, finally explode. It's kind of funny feeling to see a big ship like that turn over sideways and just lay down like it was just a lazy log, you know. It just turned over. And you could see the guys jumping off of it, you know. Because I had glasses on, and I could see. Most of them had gone towards Ford Island. See, they just jumped and got on. They only had to go maybe 20, 30 feet. They were on land. But the ones that went on the water side, then that's the way that one kid that was with us, he had to swim about as long as a football field, maybe.
You saw it in a way that not many people did.
The planes, people don't believe how many there was. There's supposed to have been 300 of them, and sometimes you think there was more, and sometimes it didn't see that many, because what guns we had, we were firing. They were making quite a few passes and strafing a lot of ships, because before they got to us, that's when they went and got the Air Force, which I didn't know, you know. At the sub base, they fired on them, and then by that time when they got to us, they knocked hell out of us too. I thought they ruined our Navy, but they mostly sunk all the old battleships that they had not much use for at that time. And the carriers, just the good Lord was notified us not to have any in there that morning. That was my biggest sadness in my life, and it still bothers me today, because at one time at Pearl Harbor before the war, there used to be 70,000 servicemen on the beach at one time on a weekend. We don't know about how many people we had in the Navy, what ships we had in the Navy. We just saw what came in there, and when that happened, it kind of depressed me, you know, thinking, am I going to be one that's not going to come back? And seeing all that destruction, you know, all them battle wagons all laying on them. Bottom, Arizona, and then that Oklahoma, it was capsized right there on that same row, and then the Utah where I was. I think our ship would have been an asset to the Japs if they could have sunk us, because we did do a lot of, I've seen it when it was in the Pacific, after I got on a different ship where they repaired a lot, they'd done a lot, they were really useful. That ship was useful because it could do anything. It had a foundry on it. It had a machine shop. It was great. It was a very, very fine ship.
That ship, the USS Medusa, the sailor Joe Quercia. You can meet him Thursday in Clovis, California, when they mark the 76th anniversary of the attack on Pearl Harbor. If you make it out there, you'll also get a taste of one of the most amazing couples I've ever met. They've been married 76 and a half years, which means they had been married for about 6 months when the world changed on them. His new bride, Dorothy, was back home in California, and Chuck Lishman was ready to complete his time on the destroyer USS Perry and head home, hoping to see his bride again.
My enlistment was up December 3rd of 41. The ship was leaving for the States December 8th, and my enlistment would have been up. So anyway, that didn't work out too well. I just had eaten breakfast and came up topside, looked out over there, and then saw these planes getting hit there at Hickam Field on Ford Island. Next thing I knew, boy, we were at war. Well, old Harshbecker, he ran up the stack and took the stack cover off and everything as the Japs were hitting everything. And the Monahan came in there, and we had a two-man sub there right off of our stern. And they laid depth charges right there and like to blew us out of the water. And, of course, that's when the plane, we hit one plane, Jap plane, it crashed on the Curtis and caught fire. We finally got underway. I was hauling shells. We were hauling 4-inch shells. We had broadside, you know, we didn't have any anti-aircraft except some 30 caliber machine guns and some 50s. If I'd have had a rifle when those suckers were flying over the top of us, I got to hit one right between the eyes. But anyway, I was picking up those 4-inch shells. They were dragging them out of the ready locker, bringing them up topside. And I was running back there, and I, you know, those 4-inch shells are so dang heavy, you could just about get one to load it in the gun. And I had one under each arm. And that Jap plane came down and strafed us, and I dove behind the stack at that time, and the bullets were ricocheting off, and besides Cole, he got hit in the jaw and the ricochet, and they took him into the hospital. But when I looked down there and I had these 2 4-inch shells, I didn't know. I thought, wow, what am I doing with these suckers, you know?
You made yourself a bomb, basically, huh?
So anyway, I got rid of those things. Took them back there to number 4 gun. I don't know what they were doing with that number 4 gun. I don't know if they were shooting them over in Honolulu or where they were shooting with them. But anyway, trying to get airplanes with a 4-inch broadside gun, what a joke. So anyway, we started taking the ship out. We went around the Nevada. Nevada was crosswise in the channel. And as we went around the Nevada, they were all yelling, get them, you know, and all that stuff, you know, what was a little old World War I four-piper destroyer, you know. Anyway, came out, we didn't find any Japanese. We weren't going to do anything anyway. Came back in, and that's when it really hit me. I mean, if anybody ever wanted to cry, that was it. The battleships were burning, the oil was there, and the guys were floating around in that oil, and the stuff was on fire, and you can't believe it, boy. Then they had this old boat in there running around, scooping up bodies. It had to look like a front loader on the front of that sucker, and they called up there Juicy Lucy. They had a big old sign across there, and they were scooping up bodies and stuff through the oil. Anyway, I'll never forget that.
How could you? And it's also rare that a day goes by for Chuck without reflection on how different things could have been for him. Not just at Pearl Harbor, but also in September of 1944, when he transferred off that destroyer-turned-minesweeper, the USS Perry, just 3 days before she was sunk.
We've been very fortunate on the Perry. It seems like every place we went, we were just ahead of it or just behind it. Now, I was on that ship. I think we had 6 naval engagements, and I don't know how many landings, I didn't even close to 11, but I was on that ship for 3.5 years off of all of that, and went to Peleliu, and 3 days the sucker was sunk. And my section was on watch. what had happened is Brand was second class, and I was third class water tender. So he made first class petty officer, and I got rated to second class petty officer, and the Navy Department wanted to send a second class water tender petty officer back to go to firing school and turbines and pumps and stuff to Philadelphia for new construction. So anyway, they came down to the fire room. I was down in the fire room, and this fellow, this ensign, came aboard, and he happened to be a neighbor of my uncle's there in Long Beach. So he came down to see me on how everything was. It just happened that way. And I told him, I said, you know, this ship is going to go down. I just have a feeling. I've been on it through all of this stuff, but I just have a feeling that this ship is going to go down this trip. And we had quite a talk to see how the family was and, you know, how you do. Next thing I knew, they came running down there in the fire room, and he said, hey, Lishman, get your gear together. You're going back to the States. Well, that was a joke, you know. I thought they were out of their minds. So anyway, that's the way it was. After I left that ship, it went up to Peleliu, got sunk. My section was on, and that's what I meant. All the fellas in my section was killed, every one of them. And Brand had taken my place for my section. I got off, he moved into my section, and he got killed.
A sobering reality that has stayed with him all these years, as Chuck and Dorothy have sought to honor all those who died in the service of our country and make sure that the lesson of Pearl Harbor and all the lessons of World War II are not lost.
I think of the poor devils that's left out there in some of these islands and whatnot. I think it's a shame. All the people that are hurt, crippled, died for the cause that they did. If you've been back to that war memorial back in Washington, D.C., well, you walk around and you see all of them, Korea and Vietnam and Pearl Harbor and Kiska and Attu and the Aleutians and the New Guinea and Guadalcanal and all that stuff and see, and I was in almost every one of those suckers. When I think how much they fought and died for this country, it really hurts me. And December 7th should be a remembrance that this country needs to be wide awake. Keep our military strong. It has to be. If we go down the tubes, we'll never fall from out. We'll fall from within.
A word of caution from a Pearl Harbor survivor. That is Chuck Lishman. He's now 97 years old. If you live in California's Central Valley, go shake his hand Thursday morning at the Clovis Veterans Memorial District. As I mentioned, that's just one of hundreds of commemorations around the country. I'm going to tell you about another one on an aircraft carrier and introduce you to a Pearl Harbor survivor you can meet there on Thursday when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. It gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.
This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and an episode that aims to prepare you for the 76th anniversary of the attack on Pearl Harbor. It's almost upon us. It'll be this coming Thursday, December 7th, 2017. If you live in Southern California, I can't imagine a more fitting place to commemorate that day than on the deck of the aircraft carrier turned museum USS Midway in San Diego. Dropping a wreath over the side to honor the fallen will be a 96-year-old who continues to organize a local chapter of Pearl Harbor survivors that is still 17 strong all these years later. Stu Headley was on the USS West Virginia on December 7th, 1941.
I've heard many people say Pearl Harbor was a defeat. I don't agree with them. My opinion is it was an eye-opener because the minute Nimitz took command, he followed Admiral Yamamoto's procedure. He built the battle fleet around the aircraft carrier.
Big change in strategy.
Yes. I never had a hatred, any animosity toward the Japanese. And I'll tell you why. I lived for a whole year out in Kamaki, and we had a Japanese maid, a Japanese gardener, husband and wife, and a darling little boy. And I loved them. I looked at it this way, when I was manning my battle station, you know, they're doing what they're told to do, just as I'm told, because when I went to get my hat put on my head, I thought I was going to be with a fire, fighting away fire and rescue party. And when I reached for my hat, I got kicked right in the seat of the pants by a first-class bosun mate Hicks. Get to your battle station on the double. This is the real thing. I grabbed my hat and ran on top sight. Planes are diving from every direction. And similar to this, a gun sets up off the deck. Mm-hmm. And it's all open underneath. I saw this pilot, Lieutenant White, shooting with his .45. Well, I dove under there with him. Now, I'm a seaman first class. He's a lieutenant commander, so I'm not going to question. But I'm thinking. And he says, son, where's your battle station? And I put it up to gun three. He says, get up there as fast as you can. As I was going up the ladder to get in the turret, here come a Japanese torpedo plane down the port side. I could see the pilot, the radioman, and the co-pilot laughing like everything. I got inside the turret, and Crosen was already in the trainer seat. Nobody was up on the gun deck, no shellman or rammers or anybody. So I went down to my battle station. When I go out to the schools, I put on a little demonstration. I point out how the Lord protected me. When I was 9 years old, I used to like to sit in the chair and lean back on the back two legs. My dad only spoke twice. Third time he acted. And you, yes, sir, and no, sir, in our house. Mm-hmm. So I was in the kitchen, and I'm leaning back on the back two legs. My dad walked in. Stuart, they made four legs and a chair to sit on the floor. Yes, sir. But how quick a nine-year-old forgets. So next time I'm leaning back, my dad says, Stuart, I'll not tell you again. Yes, sir. In this ear and out that ear. So the next time I'm leaning back, my dad walked in the kitchen, kicked the bag leg out from underneath me. I cracked my head on the floor. I said, there's got to be a better way. Now you see my legs back up under. That's 9 years old, a habit that I learned. I'm now 20 years old, and I'm in my battle station.
Normally, my feet would be on a platform. I would be bent over cranking in the dials for the elevation that they want that gun raised.
And this is a big 16-inch gun?
16-inch cannon.
How big are the projectiles in that?
It stands 5'2". It's 16 inches in diameter. They weigh 2,700 pounds. I called it a Volkswagen going out the barrel. And it takes 5 100-pound bags of black powder to hurl that shell from San Diego to Oceanside.
Uh-huh.
That is, if I've got that gun elevated to maximum height, that shell will fly 30 miles.
I just wanted people to have a sense of this isn't a little anti-aircraft gun. This the biggest you got.
So now I'm in my battle position. But we're not going to fire these 16-inch guns in Pearl. We'll blow Pearl Harbor off the map.
Yeah.
And so consequently, my feet were back up underneath me. I'm on a high stool. No back. JA phones on. And we could hear the machine gun bullets hitting the turret. We felt the thud of a torpedo. And Krausen says, "Stu, let's see what's going on." We took the sight cap off our periscope and bam, there went the Arizona. And I estimated there were about 32 bodies that flew through the atmosphere.
So I want people to understand what you're saying here. Because very few people actually saw the Arizona
explode.
They saw the aftermath. They saw the smoke, or they heard it and they turned.
We saw it.
When you looked into this viewfinder right before the bomb hit.
And see, I immediately thought that a bomb went down this stack because it looked like the ship broke in half. When I met this fellow here, I found out the truth. Jack McCarran was one that was blown off the ship into the burning oil. But he later informed me that he had been informed that an armor-piercing shell went through the starboard side of the forecastle right into number one handling room. There's 1,000 bags of black powder in each one of the handling rooms. That exploded. That set off turret two. That's what broke the ship in half.
But you're a 20-year-old kid.
I'm a 20-year-old brat growing up overnight.
And you're looking at a ship just like yours, another battleship, blowing up and bodies flying through the air.
Yep.
How do you react to that?
Startled, surprised, but waiting for the next scenario.
Sure.
Because the next scenario was an armor-piercing shell dropped from a high-level bomber came through our turret. And what he'd done, he took 15-inch armor-piercing shells. Mm-hmm. They welded fins on them so that they would spiral. Well, over top of our left gun is a catapult, and I called it a slingshot. And we had two airplanes on that catapult that morning. One was a scout observation plane, an SOU-2, and the other was the Kingfish, the Admiral's plane. Well, the scout observation is a biplane.
Yeah.
The top wing is the gas tank. The Admiral's plane is a single wing. And when that shell hit, it hit the top wing of the scout plane. The gasoline exploded, burnt the plane to a crisp, split that catapult in half, and came down through 5 inches of steel right into the left gun. And the reason I'm here today is because that shell did not explode. And here's a picture of it taken on December the 9th. That's the inside of the turret.
And I'll put this picture up at hometownheroesradio.com. And I think some people who've been paying close attention are doing the math or following your drift on this, but go ahead and connect the dots for me from don't sit on two legs of a chair to the reason you're still here.
When the Arizona blew up, we didn't know it at the time, 1,177 men died instantly aboard that ship. You ever been out to Pearl?
Sure.
You've been aboard the memorial?
Yes.
You've seen the Onyx Wall, the black, with 1,177 names. But since then, there's been about, I would say, pretty close to 50 to 100 bodies put inside the ship.
Right.
So right after that explosion, I had my feet back up under Right by my feet is a hatch, just big enough for a person to crawl through from one side to the other. It's locked down with four steel dogs. It blew that hatch right off those four steel dogs, that explosion. My footrest was just torn right off. If my feet had been out where they would be, I would have no legs, and I probably wouldn't be alive.
You wouldn't have made it off the ship.
No. Nobody would have known we were there because there was only the two of us in that right gun. And went right past my legs, underneath the elevating screw, past Crozen's legs, and landed against the barbette, picking both of us up simultaneously and throwing us 8 feet back into the elevating screw. Now, I had the JA phones on, and when I picked myself up off the deck, Crozen says, "Stu, let's get out of here." So I said, "A good idea," only he didn't say it quite that nice. And in order to get out, you got to go up a ladder to the primer deck. And when I got to the primer deck, I reached the end of the cord. And I grabbed a hold of the belt, snapped it in half, and threw the whole thing down in the pit. I spent 20 years trying to stretch one of those belts. Couldn't do it. And it wasn't until after I retired that I understood how it was possible. And I show the kids the Inquirer magazine that I had. And it says a mother lifted a one-ton car up off her son. And I said, "That's an impossibility." But I read the article, then I understood. The adrenaline flows right through your body when you're in a state of excitement. So anyhow, we got on a topside. Our ship was on about a 15-degree list. Mm-hmm. And you can see the Tennessee is on one inboard of us. Now, a shell that hit the number two turret on the Tennessee killed my captain. Captain Bennion came out of his battle station, walked around the flying bridge over to the starboard side when a shell hit the edge of number two turret. And a piece of that shrapnel flew up and went through the lookout tower and tore my vice president's leg wide open. He got the Purple Heart. I never earned a Purple Heart for the whole war and the Korean War. And I told Crozen when we got out of topside, I says, "If I don't get killed today, I'll live to see the end of this war." "How can you say that, Stu?" I said, "If you've got the faith to believe it, you can do it." He says, "I don't have that kind of faith." June 12th, 1942, he was on board the Honolulu. They took a torpedo through the bow of the ship. He was asleep in his bunk, and the steel crushed him to death.
And we're still in the early stages of this attack on the morning of Sunday, December 7th, 1941. You're up topside, but the reason you're saying, "If I survive today," is that's not a certainty. There's still a lot going on. What happened next?
Well, while Crozen and I were watching the Oklahoma capsize, 12 minutes, Ensign Sears, a junior officer of our division, was screaming for us to get over on the Tennessee. And what he wanted us to do was to straddle the line and jimmy across. Well, while we were watching the Oklahoma go over, a plane zoomed in between the two ships and machine gunned all five of our buddies, and they just toppled in between the ship.
So they're on the line between the two ships.
Yeah.
And they get picked off like sitting ducks by these Japanese machine gun bullets.
Yep.
And I could see, as you described that, that the emotions are still stirred when you recall that.
Oh, yes. And I told Crozen, "We're not going over any lines. How are we going to get over, Stu?" I says, "I don't know yet, but we'll find a way."
And find a way he would, a pretty creative and you might say daring way. We'll hear about it when we come back, and you might get him to share it face-to-face on Thursday morning in San Diego when Stu Headley presides over a 76th anniversary commemoration on the USS Midway. There's normally a cost to visit that incredible museum, but it's going to be free on Pearl Harbor Day if you arrive before 9:30 a.m. I have this information posted for you at hometownheroesradio.com, and we'll be right back after this. Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Leffler here to say I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly a 250,000 EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. Nearly 1,000 veterans have gotten to see their memorials for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Yesterday, December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy, the United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked by naval and air forces of the Empire of Japan.
That, of course, is President Franklin Delano Roosevelt addressing the nation a day after the attack on Pearl Harbor, 76 years ago this week. I'll encourage you again, wherever you live, take the time to find a commemoration in your area to attend on this coming Thursday morning. Even if you don't learn something you didn't know before, which you most likely will, I know that you'll feel something you don't feel every day. And if you're in Southern California, the place to be Thursday morning is the USS Midway Museum, where Pearl Harbor survivor Stu Headley, who just turned 96, will preside over a wreath ceremony. When we left off in his story, the then 20-year-old was trying to find a way off his burning battleship, the USS West Virginia. He had seen some shipmates climbing across a line tied to the Tennessee, and he had watched helplessly as a Japanese plane mowed them down with machine gun fire. He had to find out another way to get off that ship.
As I was watching the Oklahoma capsize, we had 5-inch 38 anti-aircraft guns that stuck out over the side of the ship. Mm-hmm. So I said, Croslin, did you ever run down a railroad track? He said, what are you talking about? I says, did you ever walk on a well, when I was a kid, I said, you're going to do it today. What do you mean? I said, you see that gun barrel? We're going to go over in the Marine casemate starboard side, climb up on that gun barrel, run across it, and jump down in the Tennessee. The gun barrel is about that big around.
Yeah, a couple that feet
five inch. And so he says, you go first. I says, okay. So I usually ask the kids, where do you think I was going when I hit the deck of the Tennessee? They don't have... I says, I was going right back up into turret 3. That's my battle station. You talk about Pavlov's law. And I was on the third rung when a Marine lifted me off with his foot. Croslin was still coming down the deck. And he said, haven't you had enough of those turrets? What do you want us to do? Get over in the beach. I says, how? Swim, you idiot. And the fire... As you saw in that picture just a minute ago, this is the oil that's blazing on the water from the ships. Croslin and I went over on the starboard side of the Tennessee. Here's all these nice, neatly piled clothes and shiny shoes. So I said, Croslin, we're going to strip down to our shorts, undershorts, and we're going to jump in. We're not going to dive. I says, we don't want to hit our head on anything. And I said, go just as deep as you can and swim underwater. Well, I qualified as an ABC swimmer in boot camp, not an underwater swimmer. But I'll guarantee I swam underwater that morning or I wouldn't be here.
How far did you have to go?
I would say about twice the distance that we are to that wall. Not too far, but with that burning oil, and like I say, I wasn't an underwater swimmer, I came up twice, and I thrash like mad to get that oil and fire away. Hottest breath I ever breathed in my life. It's a wonder it didn't scorch my lungs. Twice we broke surface the next time we were at the beach, and they took us right over to the dispensary and walked right across the deck, and it's a great big red cross. It's an open patio style with a deck all the way around with a railing, and we went up there. They examined us for any burns or any lacerations, any wounds of any kind, and they had tables and chairs and cots, a bed that they moved out, anything that they could put a body on. I was asked to speak out at UCSD, and this gal said, "Stuart, when you get to the point where you were at the dispensary, I want you to tell, you're going to be speaking to 85 doctors, surgeons, their admirals and generals, and I want you to tell them what your supplies were that morning." I says, "Kathy, you mean that?" I said, "They've got the finest of equipment and everything." "Yes." I said, "All right." So when I got to this point, they gave us a tube of unguentine ointment put on the burns. They gave us a jar of sulfa drug. That's to pour into the wounds and lacerations. Then they gave us morphine, cans of morphine, to minister to those that were dying or in dire pain. With those three items, we saved lives. Well, we were taking care of these fellows, and it's now about 9:25, and the second wave is coming in. And while we were taking care of these fellows, I looked up and I saw two planes approaching Fort Island. And I yelled, "Duck!" And we went under the benches, the tables, whatever we could. And glass just shattered all over the place. And one of the planes, when it lifted up, dropped a bomb right in the center of that patio. Now, 59 years later, on a Tiger cruise, the year 2000, we went over to Hawaii. And I told the fellas, "I want to go to that dispensary that I was in." So I walked right across the decking, walked up the stairs, and they're all dental offices across there now. I walked in, and these are corpsmen that are working with dentistry. And I said, 59 years ago, I was in this building. It was kids. "What are you talking about?" They didn't understand. They didn't know anything about the history of it. And I said, "Yes, 59 years ago, I was in this very building." Well, one of the dentists, who was a lieutenant commander, heard me. And he came over and he said, "Did I hear you right? You were in this building 59 years ago? That would have been December 7, 1941. I said, "Yes, sir." "Come here, I'll show you something." I had walked right across that decking, and I took a picture. These are the three fellows that were with me. And we stopped the car, and we took photographs of the bullet holes down the landing field.
That are still there.
Yep.
Yep.
And this is a picture where I walked across the decking, but when he took me back down, I took a picture of what he showed me. That's where the bomb hit.
They have one tile in the floor there now that says, has a bomb, and it says December 7th, 1941.
Yep.
But on that date, I mean, this is a tile that's there now memorializing that.
Great big red cross was painted across that deck so that from the air you would know that it was a dispensary or a hospital.
But that's exactly where they hit.
That's where they hit.
It was X marks the spot.
You better believe it.
And what was the impact? What was the result of that bomb?
Well, dust flew all over everywhere, and I would say it was about 5 to 7, 8 minutes later that the dust cleared away. We looked over the banister. We didn't see a speck of red anywhere. Just literally tore that whole thing and turned it upside down.
The cross was gone.
Gone.
What about the patients that you guys had been treating?
They were still on the beds, but glass was all over them and everything. And there were about, I'd say, pretty close to 50 to 100 fellows that were helping. They grabbed everybody they could, even those that were on Fort Island or those that came in off the ships.
Like you guys.
Yeah. And I'm going to put you to a test.
Uh-oh.
It's about 9:45. They told us you're needed back aboard ship to help fight fire. So they put us in a boat, took us back to our ship, and aboard the West Virginia, we had just gotten a new captain, Captain Benyon, and a new executive officer, Helen Cotter. And as soon as I got on the ship, the chief told me, Headley, you're going to handle the hose with the exec. He's going to handle the nozzle. You're going to hold the hose. When he cracked the hatch to the 3rd Division compartment, boom, boom, and I thought the Japanese are back, but it wasn't. The heat was so intense in the compartment that the moment he cracked that hatch and the air went in, it blew out our portholes.
Mm.
Took 45 minutes to cool that compartment down. And when we got it cooled down, I said, Commander, could I check my locker? He says, where's your locker, son? I said, right there in the corner. Go right ahead. I opened up my locker. There's my blues, my dungarees, my whites, my underclothes, my socks, a pair of shoes, my pea coat, a sweater, my hats, all stowed away just as neat as anything. But the minute I touched them, they turned to powder from the heat. And it was amazing because I opened up the drawer, and the stupidest thing, instead of sending my photographs home with the negatives, that locker drawer was just one mass of goo. Everything was gone. So then I opened the bottom drawer, and I had a pearl buckle in there because I was making square knot belts out of Belfast cord.
Uh-huh.
And there was a half penny. Now, the story about the half penny goes back to October the 11th. The battleship Warspite, British battleship Warspite, came into port. They volunteered a group of us sailors to go over and mingle. And I was assigned to this British sailor. And he said, you know, he said, I don't have much that I could give you, but come on down to my locker and we'll see what I can find. So he took out this half penny and he said, I'll give you this. And he said, you know, you'll be in this war right alongside of us before long. I said, no. I said, we'll send you planes and tanks and ammunition. But and I thought to myself, what a prophecy when I saw that half penny.
Mm.
And I've still got that half penny. I drilled a hole through it and put a chain in it.
I'd love to see it. You know, you've described all this, and I know you've told your story hundreds of times, if not thousands of times. And I can't imagine how many lives have been impacted by your willingness to tell this story. But I'm struck by how much detail you remember. And the one thing I'm trying to figure out is how? How did you do all this? How did you manage to keep on going? And how terrified were you with this situation that nothing could have prepared you for?
Yes, there was a preparation. Because, see, we were out there a whole year before the attack. And we had battle drills. We had gun drills. We had man overboard drills. We had all kinds of drills that we were continuously practicing. So when the real thing happened, we're prepared and we do just what we're trained to do.
But
and you don't stop. And
but, Stu, you saw bodies flying through the air. Then your body was blown back 8 feet. And you're holding your breath underwater because there's fire on the top. And you get to the beach. And when you get there, there's all these guys who are injured and maimed and dying. And you're treating them only to get bombed again where you're treating them. I mean, how can anything prepare you for that? And what was it that... Yeah, that was it.
The Lord prepared me for everything. He assured me, I will never leave you nor forsake you. I will be with you whatever you go through. That was where my faith was and my trust. That was all during the war. I went through 13 major engagements aboard the next ship, the San Francisco. The biggest battle we were in was Guadalcanal. Our ship was literally demolished. Eddie Huber and I were with damage control. We were electricians.
Mm-hmm.
We were assigned to go up and take over Gun 6. He was going to be the trainer. I was going to be the pointer. Gun 6 is the only gun that didn't get demolished. Gun 1, Gun 3, Gun 5, and 7 on the starboard side all took 14-inch shell hits. Gun 2, Gun 4, Gun 8 were wiped out. While we were on Gun 6, Gun 4 was destroyed. Joe Hubbard, who was our senior damage control officer, was walking on the deck behind us. When Gun 4 got hit, a piece of the shrapnel of the blast shield took his head right off his shoulders.
Oh.
He walked about 8 steps and then collapsed and died. We had 75% of our officers killed in 45 minutes aboard that ship. The admiral was killed, the captain was killed, the executive officer was killed, the gun boss was killed, Joe Hubbard, damage control officer, he was killed. We had 236 died that night. And the next morning, I was asked to help identify bodies. Well, we had a dog tag, two of them, on a chain around our neck. So I told Dr. Mamonis, I'll gladly do that for you. So I started with gun 7, 5 bodies. And I opened their mouth, put the dog tag between their teeth, clamped their jaws shut, put a red tag on them. I come up to gun 5. This is the most horrible experience of my life. I told you about Johnny Anderson, who was in that boat when he saw the torpedo wake, and he was supposed to have been in turret 3 in the left gun,
right.
But he wasn't there. Well, he was a pointer on this 5-inch 25, and the shell came right through and tore him in half. His head and shoulders were underneath the vent. His lower torso and legs were dangling. I started laughing, and Dr. Mamonis doubled up his fist and hit me as solid as he could in the jaw. And he said, Headley, you have every right to report me because an officer has no authority to strike an enlisted man. But if I hadn't have done it, you would have gone stark raving mad. Snap me out of it. I went ahead and continued identifying bodies up the starboard side and down the port. And shortly after, fellow said, Headley, how about taking the watch in Central Station? This is about 10:30 in the morning, and I've got the JA phones on, and all of a sudden I hear 3 torpedo wakes on our port bow. I went up 5 flights of ladders, 5 decks, hit topside. Don Jenkins, first-class electrician, said, Stu, who's in Central Station? I said, no one. He went right down. Those 3 torpedoes passed between the Helena and the Frisco and hit the Juno. And in 9 seconds, clocked on our chronometer in the bridge, there was no ship afloat. Wiped right out.
Yet another close call in a life full of them. If you're in San Diego, I hope you'll go meet Stu Headley on Thursday and help him honor the fallen. He is absolutely relentless in telling the story of Pearl Harbor and keeping it alive for one important reason.
I'll put it this way. It relates to our motto. Remember Pearl Harbor. Keep America alert. America is asleep. It has been ever since the beginning of World War II. Just to give you an example, 95% of the people of our country don't know what our boys went through.
Well, we all know a little more now, thanks to Stu Headley, 96-year-old Pearl Harbor survivor. Like the dozens of other Pearl Harbor survivors we've had the privilege of meeting here on Hometown Heroes over the years, he takes that duty, that quest to keep America alert, oh so solemnly. Don't let December 7th pass on by without taking time out to pause and reflect. And if you have the chance to go meet some survivors in your area, I promise you it will be a small investment of your time that you will not regret. That's our program today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.